Hello and welcome to a very special edition of the Bruin Podcast. This week, we're thrilled to bring you an exclusive interview with the former Secretary of State for the Department of Exiting the European Union, the Right Honourable David Davis, MP. Such was the generosity of Mr. Davis's time and such is the richness of the debate, we've had to split the podcast into two sections this week. Part one, and this edition, which you're about to listen to, describes what David Davis did during his time in DEXU, the government's no-deal planning and the major challenges of the proposed deal. Part two, available in an additional podcast, covers trade policy, the potential implications for a failed vote and the prospects for a leadership challenge. But before any of this, please listen first to our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Bruin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Mr. Davis, thank you very much for joining us. Perhaps we could start. Obviously, the Prime Minister is now on her third minister for leaving the exiting the European Union, and there's been a reasonable amount of controversy about what the ministers in question are actually able to do. Perhaps you could describe to us what you were able to do when you were in that position.
Well, I mean, it's changed, of course, since then. I mean, what's happened with each new Secretary of State is it's got narrower. In the first instance, if you start with the clear understanding the Prime Minister is the principal negotiator, that's what people forget. The Prime Minister is the principal negotiator, and then, in essence, what the role was for me was to deputise and advise. And so DEXU, on my watch, produced a whole series of policy papers as to what our strategy should be, advised and instructed the negotiating teams that went to Brussels, also did the preparation for the various contingency outcomes ranging from no deal to a deal outcome and what we had to do, because each one requires preparation. That's 300 projects in its own right. So a whole range of things right across the board, and of course advised the Prime Minister on what the diplomatic, political, economic and negotiating aspects of every strategy were.
And what is the state of our no deal planning then? Because that's something that's happened.
Well, it's more advanced than people think.
Right.
I mean, one of the reasons for the perception of this is that in the early part of this year, when it was originally planned to put some of the no deal planning in the public domain around about March, the intention was to tell companies what they need to do, prepare, and so on. But in practice, the Treasury and other departments were very nervous about doing that in March because that was the point at which we had just got agreement on the implementation period, you know, the 21 months in which we would be able to prepare, so taking us up to 2020. And that, of course, raised an increase in business confidence, and they didn't want to put cold water on that. So that was one of the reasons it was delayed. Now, the truth with any number of projects, anything we've got vast numbers of projects like that, and I say about 300 different critical parts, is that there's always about 10% of them behind time at any point in time, and then you go fix those, and another point, 10% behind. I mean, are behind, and that's what's going on. What is the case now? Well, I've been out for a few months, but my hunch is that most of them are fine. There are about 100 or so critical projects. And some of those, if we think no deal is going to happen, we'll have to step up the pace on in the last 3-6 months. So that's where it'll be. I am confident of two things. It will not be the dystopia that some people worry about, or indeed the utopia that some people think. And some things will go wrong, but most things will go right. That's what you'd expect. It's a way of fixes.
Any idea which kind of things would fall into which of those
two? If I knew that, we'd fix them, wouldn't we? But, for example, let me pick sort of speculative things. You can't predict. A lot of people worry about the Dover-Calais crossing.
Yeah.
And they worry for two reasons. They worry partly because it's a sort of choke point, but they also worry because they think France might act up. You know, Macron has been quite aggressive in this negotiation so far. In practice, if they do, I suspect it'd be quite symbolic, because the pain from the French point of view would be quite sizable. Because if you block the journey one way from Dover to Calais, you also block it the other way. It's like a sort of conveyor belt going round, or a carousel at an airport. Right. And it's the same ship that takes lorries from Britain to France as bring them from France to Britain. So, if we do have a problem there, there are contingency plans for dealing with it. But I doubt it would last that long. Even if it did last weeks, we've had this before. In 2015, Project Stack, as it's called, when all the lorries are parked along the motorways, there was a French driver strike. I think it lasted 5 weeks, from memory. And we didn't run out of food. We didn't run out of medicines. We didn't run out of insulin, the one that was the scare stories about recently, for a variety of reasons. And as far as I'm aware, no just-in-time factories shut down or declared shortages of goods. Part of the reason was people always plan for some buffer. Part of it is you can see some of it coming, and so you can plan for that. Part of it is you can deflect. My best estimate of the ability to deflect is that if you have to stay with the same mode, i.e. Ro-Ro got to get a Ro-Ro, or container got to get a container, you've got about 20% ability to move traffic out of Dover. If you can change the mode...
So, sorry, what does that mean to move
20% traffic? Of the throughput could move to other ports.
To Folkestone or something.
Tilbury, Felixstowe, Hull, Ipswich, all those ports. And on the other side, of course, Rotterdam, Zeebrugge, Antwerp, and so on. But if you can change the mode, you can get a 40%. So that's quite a lot of trade can be deflected, and that's what I suspect happened in 2015. So you know, there are plans like that which are designed. Other issues are pharmaceuticals. There was a lot of fuss about, oh, can we use medicines? Well, all we do is we alter the British law, so we accept the European Medicines Agency's approvals automatically. That's not very difficult either. For the time being, you can do things later. So quite a lot of things of that sort of nature, well worked through. And other things where if we think there is a problem with throughput at our end, then let us say on animal inspection, well, you know, Europe's not suddenly going to become full of diseased animals the day after we leave, any more than it is the day before. The day before, we don't inspect at all. So we can do very light touch inspection, just to keep an eye on areas that perhaps have got disease breakouts, which is what we would do now. So quite a lot of things require less change than you imagine. And the other side of preparing pretty carefully, I mean, we know that, for example, take Calais. We know that Calais has already started recruiting its customs officers, extra customs officers. We know they're putting in place what they call a fast pass system for approved drivers. We know they picked two sites to do inspections of animals at. So there's a lot going on. And we also know that the regional political imperative in Hauts-de-France, which would include Calais, that's Monsieur Xavier Bertrand, a very powerful French politician. He's determined that we're going to maintain throughput, and he wants a good deal for both sides. Similarly, in Flanders, the president of Flanders and Mr. Bourgeois, he said the same thing. And I know I've talked to the mayor of Antwerp, who's determined to do the same thing as well. So there's across the board, there's a lot of preparation going on.
Okay, and the Obviously, we've got this withdrawal bill now, which has been negotiated. And perhaps, I think we're probably aware of your sort of general feelings about it, but perhaps you could sort of summarise the main issues that you have with it.
In the withdrawal bill, well, there was a great deal of argument. I mean, the biggest controversy around the withdrawal bill, I mean, for your listeners, the withdrawal bill essentially is the bill that takes us, does the legal part of taking us out of the European Union. It stops the application of the European Communities Act 1972, and then sets in place the mechanisms to replace the law. So if you have a European regulation and you want to replace it with a British regulation and maybe a British regulatory authority, it allows you to do that by statutory instrument. That's a secondary legislation. And there's an awful lot of that. But the other thing that became, and that's quite technical, but the other thing that became politically controversial about this, one was the fact that quite a lot of secondary legislation was being used to do this. Now, this would be, to some extent, this argument was posturing, because actually very few laws will change very much. They'll just become British rather than European, right? So there was a lot of posturing about it, but nevertheless, we had the argument. And we put lots and lots of checks and balances in to ensure that Parliament had its say. But the other big argument was from those who don't want us to leave, who wanted to put in place what they called a meaningful vote. So I said, yeah, sure, you can have a vote. You can have a vote on whether you approve the deal or not. What you can't have is a vote that says we're not leaving, because that decision was taken in the Article 50 bill, and it was a decision before that by the 17.4 million people, and a decision before that when the referendum bill went through almost, not unanimously, but by a massive majority, on the basis that the referendum would make the decision, not advise, but make the decision. So I said you can have a meaningful vote, take it as sort of accept it or don't accept it. If you don't accept it, then we're on to a no deal. We're not on to stopping the whole process. So the presumption built into the law is that we leave. Yeah, that's the point. And it's very important to understand that. A lot of people say, oh, well, we might change our mind. It's incredibly difficult for parliamentarians to change the mind of the country over whether we leave or not, unless the government decides to change its mind. Because we have in Britain a thing called the right of initiative of government. In other words, I as a backbencher can't create a law ab initio. Only the government could do that. So it's set up that way. It's set up to be on the presumption of leaving.
So what are the specific points of the withdrawal bill that you don't like?
Oh, I do like it. There's nothing about it I don't like, because I approved every bit of it. That's not where the controversy in this issue really is. Well, it's controversy across the floor of the House, but it's not the controversy within government over it. The areas where I have a difference with government is in the negotiating policy and the negotiating structure and the negotiating targets that the government have gone for.
Okay, well, perhaps you could expand that? On those then. Yeah.
Well, the most famous one, really, I guess, was the argument we had at Chequers in June, when I told the Prime Minister that I thought there were four parts of her proposals which I thought were bad, but two of them were fatally so. One was the idea that we should adopt what was called the Common Rule Book. Now, the Common Rule Book is the set of regulations that apply to manufactured goods generally. And a lot of British business argued, well, you know, we don't mind these regulations, we don't care if we continue to get regulations from Europe and so on. And maybe if it's a sort of stable industry like the chemical industry or some parts of engineering, whatever, that's fine if things stay pretty stable. But the problem is future industries. We are going to be dominant in gene technology, life sciences generally, artificial intelligence, other elements of data management and so on. We're very, very good at those things. We have a huge intellectual advantage in this country there. Now, we're going to be world leaders in this. But how can you be a world leader if somebody else determines your regulations? And by accepting the Common Rule Book, what that really means is we accept the rule book laid down by the European Union. And the union has in the past shown itself perfectly willing to use its rule book, use its regulations to disadvantage one or other competitor. The most famous example of this was the Dyson vacuum cleaner. When the commission effectively said, Dyson is a cyclone vacuum cleaner, it's competing with filter vacuum cleaners. Okay, we'll have the test of the vacuum cleaners done in a dust-free environment so the filters don't clog up. Now, what a daft idea to test vacuum cleaners with no dust. But they did that in order to create or to limit the advantage of Dyson. You can see the same sorts of things happening in other areas where we have a competitive advantage. So that's the first big, big issue. The second big issue was on the question of the so-called future customs arrangement. Now, what the government wanted to do was to create a customs barrier around us so that if a good came in, let's say from China, and it was en route to the European Union, we would collect the tariff.
Yeah.
Right? And then pass it on to the European Union. The simple truth is, one, I thought it was impractical. It'd take a long time, and indeed my judgments at the time, which were just judgments from my own experience, have been reinforced by leading organisations in Europe who are freight forwarders and customs agents and so on. They think it could take 10 years to make it work. So that's the first thing. Second thing, I don't think it's right for us to be tax collectors for somebody else. Thirdly, the very fact that we are would be tax collectors for them means the European Court would have a say. So much for controlling our own borders, so much for taking the European Court's remit out of Britain. So that's the secondary issue. The third one was...
So has that made it into the...
Well, it did, but the government's now beginning to change its mind. This very week, as we speak, I think today in one of the newspapers, there was an assertion that the government's now thinking again about the alternative approach, the one I designed, which is the accelerated, or it's called MaxFact, maximum facilitation, but it's really just accelerated customs procedures, using existing procedures with the best IT that you can get. And that's it. And they're now beginning to look at that. But unfortunately, they should have been doing this in June, not now. So we're a bit behind the game on that. So
was that agreed with the checkers style approach, or the future customs arrangement? Yeah. Was that agreed with the EU? Because themselves.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, that's my fourth point. In a second, if I come back.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
The third point was on the idea of having a temporary customs union, so we stay inside the customs union for a while we complete various things. I talked to the Prime Minister about that, and one of my roles in life was to look at what the civil service had delivered to the Prime Minister and say, that will or won't work for whatever reason. Let me see if I can make it work. I used to call it finding the touchline. My job was, I'm a rugby player, my job was to find the touchline of the Prime Minister. If you go over the touchline, you can't do it. And I said that the temporary customs arrangement will only work if, one, it concludes well before the next election, so that we're actually properly out before the next election, and secondly, that we decide. Nobody else decides, but we decide at the end of the day, only on clear criteria maybe, but we decide. And initially we agreed, and then later on we disagreed on it, and that's one of the third checkers thing. The fourth checkers element was my negotiating judgment that she would that what she was putting up was not the final case. It was just another bid from us, and the European Union would not be won over by this. I mean, a lot of this argument was based on the idea of somehow breaking a logjam with the European Union. I just didn't believe that would work. I said all that happened was I come back and make some more bids, and that's precisely what's happened since. So those four reasons were the primary reasons for my disagreement with checkers, and indeed my resigning from government. And as you're seeing, some of them are now coming home to roost. I mean, there was I don't know if you remember the day of the Salzburg summit, when the Prime Minister was treated fairly badly by European Union leaders. And I was speaking in Munich that day. And I got on the plane to come back, and of course your phone is disconnected for the time you're on the plane. when I landed, there were 20 texts on my phone from journalists saying, you predicted all this, what comes next? Well, all except one, which was would be an unnamed radio program, said, you predicted all this, would you like to come on and gloat? And I said, no. So much of this has been foreseeable, and it pretty much played out as I expected.